thanks for tuning in to On the Same Page, a new podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library to keep you in the loop and on the same page about what's happening at your library. Welcome back to On the Same Page. Thanks for tuning in. We're your hosts. That's Erica.
I'm Erica.
And I'm Abby, librarians at the Central Library. We recorded this episode at our annual in-service day, which is where all of the staff of all of the JMRL locations get together to work on staff training and development. And so we were closed on the 7th for that.
Yes. So in our last episode, we did say we would have some interviews with staff members from this in-service day, and we do have those, but we are not using them today. We instead were granted permission to record the local author that came to talk to us about his book about Nelson County, Virginia.
The author that came to speak was Stefan Bechtel, and he was talking about his book, The Roar of the Heavens, which is about when Hurricane Camille hit Nelson County. And the reason that he was speaking is because one of our locations, which you may not know, is in Nelson County. The Nelson Memorial Library is one of our branches.
In Livingston, right on 29.
Yes, and we, for this staff training day, we were in, not in the library because it's a little bit too small to accommodate all of our staff, but we were across the parking lot in the Nelson Community Center. And for those of you that don't know, the Nelson Memorial Library was actually built with a memorial fund for the victims of Camille in Nelson County. So he was giving a little background into our location.
Yeah, so we got to hear about the devastation that Camille brought to Nelson County, which is a very sad story that he tells very well.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us weren't familiar with it. Either we didn't grow up in Nelson County or we weren't alive in 1969.
Yes. So it's a good introduction to some local history that really had a huge impact on part of the community.
And his speech and reading from his book is introduced by our branch manager of the Nelson County Library, Susan Huffman.
But before we get into all that, we're going to have a brief chat about books. I am in the process of reading Books for Living by Will Schwalbe?
I don't know.
You've read this.
I have. I've read both of his books, actually.
His other book is
The End of Your Life Book Club.
That's right. And so that's the one where he reads books with his mom as she's
dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this one, he is talking about, I think it must be about, 30 books that he has used to kind of shape his worldview, or his philosophy on life, I guess.
Yeah.
And so each book he, gives some summary or insight or here's what it's about or here's what I got out of it or what stuck with me from it. Mm-hmm. And relates it to a specific story in his life, and then there's sort of a lesson he carries from it. So it's really interesting. Some of them are books I've never heard of. Others are books that I know very well. But it's a neat idea.
Yeah, I don't remember which books it was, but a couple of them I was I don't agree.
Yeah.
That I think you're using this book in a different way than I've ever seen this book used. So, I mean, that's how books work. Everyone has their own interpretation. He's an excellent writer. This is a very quick read.
Yes.
Very easy to dip in and out of.
Yeah, each chapter is just a couple pages long. And by chapter, I mean each book that he talks about. And he talks about each book within a certain framework. So this book he talks about in the framework of remembrance or something like that, and then this one is
I liked this book. I didn't like it quite as much as The End of Your Life Book Club, just because that had such a Tuesdays with Maury storyline.
I still haven't read that.
It's good. You've read Tuesdays with Maury, right?
Yeah,
just the reconnecting with a person you care about in a specific way while they're fading from life.
Okay, yeah, so some of the themes he uses are connecting, remembering, choosing kindness, which is Wonder. So if you haven't read Wonder yet,
I still haven't
read
Wonder.
That and then go see the movie.
I still haven't read it.
You should read the book. It'll take you 2 hours. So the book we're talking about is R.J. Palacio's book,
Wonder. Is it a show or something?
That's a good question. We are destroying her name right now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think she'd mind. She seems really awesome.
Yeah, it's very in demand right now because a movie did just come out. And I believe it's cleaning up at the box office.
I will talk about a book I read 2 weeks ago called Being Mortal. It was very popular a couple years ago. I think it came out in 2014. I did not jump on that bandwagon. It is written by Atul Gawande. He is a surgeon in Boston, a very well-regarded surgeon, and also he writes about medicine. This is like his third or fourth book, and in this one he tackles how we deal with the end of life medically and how maybe we need to revisit that. Right now, there's no point at which doctors will stop treating you if you're dying. There's always something more they can do, even if it's just putting you on a ventilator. And that doesn't always lead to the best quality of life in the final months of some illnesses. And so he kind of surveys the landscape of what's being done to give people, as they age, a higher quality of life, even when they have a terminal diagnosis. He visits some assisted living programs that are doing really interesting things with pets and like community meals, and he talks about how to make it possible to live, you know, on your own independently for as long as possible, and when to consider alternate situations, like when it's too taxing on children to take care of an aging parent, and also how important it is to have hard conversations, to ask people what they want their final months or weeks or days to look like, what experiences would be worth saving their life for versus, you know, when intervention shouldn't be taken because that their wishes are for that instead. So it certainly made me want to have conversations with my family members to make sure we've all expressed our wishes and we have that in writing and made it legal. And
those are heavy conversations to have.
Yeah, but it was he handles it so delicately. And it's so interesting because he says, he's very honest and upfront. He's like, I as a surgeon, I've done this. I've said, yeah, let's keep doing chemo right to the end, even though it's not always the most comfortable procedure and it doesn't necessarily stretch life. But some people want to fight, and doctors definitely want to fight with everything they have. So finding that balance of fighting versus letting it unfold in a more
natural way.
But yeah, knowing what your limits are. Doing everything we can to ensure quality of life.
There you go.
Instead of extension of life.
Well, that's depressing.
It wasn't depressing, though.
I guess that's the point.
I think...
is that death doesn't have to be depressing, right?
Yeah. He talks about that, like, being accepting of it. Of course, as a surgeon, as, you know, any doctor, really, in a hospital, you get used to it at a certain point. So it's not as personal for you as it is for each individual patient and their family, which I think can lead to focusing on it medically instead of on it holistically. No, it's very good. I just wish that that conversation expanded. I wish that this book and its popularity had led to some drastic changes in the way we approach it. And he thinks it's coming, but it's not here yet.
I want to introduce the speaker for this afternoon, but I want to preface that by telling you that 1969 was a pivotal year in Nelson County. It seems like everything that happened before that is noted by 1969, and everything that has come after that all comes back to 1969. For those of you that are my age, you know that Hurricane Camille, which came in Gulfport, Mississippi, as a Category 5 hurricane, and then died out a couple days later after doing mass destruction in Mississippi, decided to come up and settle over the mountains just over Nelson County and have a little visit. So I want to share with you some facts about what happened August 19th and 20th in 1969. On that evening, sometime between 11 and 4 o'clock, between 27 and 31 inches fell in the mountains of Nelson County. During the peak river discharge, that was all the rivers coming into the James River, with flood water, liquid soil, and mountain rock, it was estimated that 36 million gallons came in the James River per minute. At one point during the morning of the 20th, the volume of water coming down the Tie River from the Rockfish and the Piney and all the creeks caused the James River to back up for a period of hours. And just some statistics so I can get the right, I'm going to read them to you. As of September the 8th, 1969, the state had counted 107 deaths and 102 injuries. The majority of death and damage occurred in Nelson County, Virginia. Of the 313 houses destroyed, 250 were located in Nelson County. Of the 415 houses that suffered major damage, 225 of those were located in the county. Of the 153 people died or missing in Virginia, 126 of those residents were from Nelson County. And a little more than 1% of the population of Nelson County died. Those 54 people all lived along the 4-mile stretch of Davis Creek. Communications, including roads, were completely destroyed in every community. Of course, we know during that time, TV went off at 12 o'clock and didn't come on again until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. After the flood, there was only one highway in the whole state of Virginia that was intact. There were some 133 bridges that were destroyed or damaged, and 25 miles of primary and 170 miles of secondary roads were obliterated, with damage totaling $19 million in 1969. There have been three books written about Hurricane Camille. Torment was written in 1970, 1 year after the flood. It was written by Paige and Jerry Simpson. And they did a count-by-count detail of people who died, pictures, and part of the proceeds of that book helped build Nelson Memorial Library. And in fact, some of that money still remains intact for us to use for special projects. The second was Category 5. It was written from the perspective of the psychologist, and it was done in 2005. But by far, the best account of the flood was Roar of the Heavens, written by Stefan Bechtel. This book takes the reader all the way into that evening. You can see that night. I remember that night. You can see that night in his vivid portrayal. You can see the aftermath. He talks to lots and lots of different survivors, but he does it in a way that you feel like that you're there and experiencing the event all over. Stefan is the author. He has co-authored and authored 12 books. His work has appeared in Esquire magazine and the Washington Post. He's a longstanding member of the American Association of Journalists and Authors. And Stefan is a 3-time fellow of the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, which is just up the street from us. And we are delighted to have him this afternoon to talk about Roar of the Heavens and also some of the other books that he has. So thank you, and Stefan. It's awesome.
The last time I came down here to talk, there was 5 people. Better get my notes in order. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. You know, my mom was a librarian. I love librarians. I always feel comfortable in librarians. So I guess I've been quite fortunate in my life as a writer in that I've actually been able to make a living most of the time by following, you know, my bliss. You know, just getting interested in something and following it this way, following it that way. My 12th book just came out here a few months ago, which is about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and the spiritualists. Maybe we'll have a little bit of time to get to that. But the main thing I wanted to talk about is Hurricane Camille, which is an astounding story. And I felt so touched and so privileged to be a person to come down here and tell this story. When I get interested in this originally, I was talking to people on the phone, and this distinguished elderly lady said, I said I wanted to write about Hurricane Camille, and she said, "The field is overplowed." So I thought, well, I just didn't see that a book had been written that really told this whole incredible story, that told the story of the meteorology, that told the story of what happened down in Mississippi, and also what happened when it came up here into Nelson County. And I'm also someone who loves superlatives, and the story is so filled with superlatives, it's easy to tell. But, and I actually live in Charlottesville, and I've come down here several times to talk about the book during these various memorials and remembrances. And, you know, I do feel almost like this is a sacred place, a sacred ground, because of the tragedy that took place here. So I'd like to take you back in time, back to a hot summer night, almost exactly 50 years ago, which is a long time ago. It was the night of August 19th, 1969. Back then, gas was about 35 cents a gallon. You could buy a VW bus for a bug for about $1,799. A can of Campbell's soup was 11 cents. Color TV had just appeared, but people thought it was a fad. Remember how bad color TV was when it first came out? No cell phones, no internet, no blogosphere, if you can imagine. It was also a very interesting moment in American history. Richard Nixon was in the White House. The Vietnam War had become this terrible, bloody quagmire, and the country was just convulsed with anti-war demonstrations. The death tolls from that war were staggering. Go back and look at the newspapers. It was not uncommon for 100 soldiers to die in a week or more. Just a month earlier, Neil Armstrong had set foot on the moon, and the whole country was just crazy about it. Pierre Cardin had just announced his new fall fashion line called the Moon Collection for the world of tomorrow. So there was a picture in the paper of a model in a little black cocktail dress surrounded by something that looked like either a hula hoop or a ring of little orbiting planets. I don't know how well that went over. And in upstate New York, all roads leading into a certain alfalfa field near the little town of White Lake were absolutely jammed. In fact, parts of the New York State Thruway had basically been shut down because 400,000 kids had shown up for something called the Woodstock Aquarium Music and Art Fair. So by some amazing coincidence, Camille came ashore the same weekend as Woodstock. And the NASA meteorologist who worked with me on this book said you can tie in the charts that all that mud and rain in Woodstock was Camille. But down here in Nelson County, people were living a life that seemed a million miles away from there. Life was sweet, life was slow, people liked it like that. Earl Hamner, of course, would later create the TV series The Waltons, based on his childhood memories of growing up in Nelson and the Depression. But in 1969, life in Nelson was not all that different. It was as if the rest of the country were watching The Waltons on TV while the people in Nelson were living The Waltons. August 19th, it was high summer, but you could just start to feel a little bit of autumn in the air some nights. The peaches were ripe. It was the end of baseball, the beginning of football. Some mornings when the weather was cool, you could hear a change in the sound of the insects in the trees. Everything was still green, but your heart was kind of grieving for the green. You knew it would be gone soon. Idlers whiled away the afternoon in the square in Lovingston, a bowling store in Massey's Mill, where kids went to get a cold drink. There was a sign on the door with a picture of a penguin and the words, "Come on in, it's cool inside." Air conditioning was a relative novelty. Bobby Ray Floyd was playing football with his team, the Nelson County All-Stars, in a field south of Lovingston. They just won the 16-inch slow-pitch softball tournament in Lynchburg. They were just tearing it up that year. And it was around twilight, the top of the ninth, when the sky began to darken rather ominously, and weird leaden cloud masses started blooming over the Blue Ridge. Very weird. Ivanhoe Stevens stopped in his garden and stared up in the sky. Then he went and got his wife and got her to come outside and take a look at these clouds, too. Everybody noticed these weird clouds. When it began to thunder and fat drops started to fall, the All-Stars decided to postpone the practice until the next day. It's true that there had been some news in the paper about a terrible hurricane called Camille, but that was way down in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast, which was unimaginably far away, 800 miles away. And besides, that was a hurricane. There's no hurricanes here, obviously. As the Nelson County All-Stars climbed into their car, somebody called out, "Well, see you all tomorrow, God willing, and the creek don't rise." Bobby Ray Floyd never forgot that comment. I probably didn't pronounce that exactly. exactly right, the way we all would. I'm a Yank, actually. Bobby Ray Floyd, he never forgot that comment because nobody, not even the National Weather Service, had any inkling of what was about to happen next. At that moment, almost everyone in Nelson County was in deadly danger, but nobody knew it. In fact, the Daily Progress weather report that day said, it will rain tonight and be sunny tomorrow, which was true. It was about 9 o'clock when it really started to rain in earnest, just pounding, relentless rain. It rained like it had never rained before, and it just kept raining. Bill Whitehead, who was the sheriff, he'd gone to bed down in Rosewood, but his wife woke him up because she was terrified of all the thunder and lightning. He got up, looked out the window, and pulled open the window and saw a sight that was so astonishing it simply did not register. Hat Creek, which is normally, you can step over it practically in the summertime. It was normally just a little farm creek so small that you could barely break a stride when you're stepping over it. It was now a raging torrent a quarter mile wide with white caps like the Chesapeake Bay. He saw trees, he saw pieces of houses, he saw even terrified cows go flying past like in a dream. When the sheriff went outside, it was raining so hard he had to cover his mouth just to breathe. And virtually everyone said that. And it's just hard to imagine that essentially a lake is dropping out of the sky. And in order to breathe, you have to go like this. Birds drowned in the trees. The few stream gauges that were not washed away showed that the flood peaked about 3 o'clock in the morning on August 20th. And sometime in the night, in the darkness, people began hearing this fearsome roar as the mountainsides began to collapse. And a fast-moving earth lava of mud, rocks, and pulverized trees crashed down into Massey's Mill and Tyro and Davis Creek, burying houses, cars, cattle, tractor trailers, and everything else in its path. Everyone described this odor in the air, this smell of deeply turned earth mixed with the smell of ground up wood and bark, like a sawdust or sawmill type of thing. Some of this mountain soil may not have been disturbed for centuries, so you could say it was the smell of deep time itself. Colleen Thompson's mother-in-law's house, filled with water, shuddered and then exploded, and she was swept 4 miles downstream. Her daughter Bonnie was never found. Her friend, Buzz Thompson, Big Buzz, was a huge guy who was always terrified of water. He was found weeks later buried in the riverbed, but he'd saved 3 people before he died, including a blind boy. Colleen Thompson always said he was the hero of the flood. Bobby Ray Floyd got to wash all the way down the mountainside from his house, clutching his little 3-year-old daughter, Sue Bell. He survived, although he couldn't walk for a month afterwards. Warren Raines, who was 14 years old at the time, clung to a tree in the flood all night and with his brother, and later found out that he lost both his parents, his little brother, and a sister that night. The sorrowful thing about the Raines story is that they left the house in Massey's Mill, climbed into the car, and they were going to drive up the hill, up around the corner, and the car stalled out because the water was coming up so fast. So they got out of the car and they started walking up the road as fast as they could, but the water was rising so fast they were just swept off their feet. And Warren and his brother managed to grab onto a tree and cling to it all night. The next day, it turned out that family dog, a black lab, had just gone upstairs in the house and lay down on the bed and was fine. They would have all survived if they had just stayed home. But who knew? No one could conceive of this. No one had any warning of this. And of course, the Huffman family over on Davis Creek was the family that was hit the hardest. 19 members of that family killed that one night. So everybody remembers Hurricane Katrina a few years ago, but Camille was a dramatically more violent storm. I've read recently that some meteorologists say that the ferocity of Camille has been exaggerated over the years, but I've looked into this and I don't believe it. When you look at the ranking of these hurricanes, Camille is right near the top. In fact, in terms of wind speed, Camille was the most violent storm ever to make landfall in the continental United States. It wasn't nearly as big as Katrina, but it was much more powerful. When she came ashore about 50 miles east of New Orleans shortly before midnight on August 17th, she had sustained winds of 200 miles an hour with gusts even higher. Since anything over 155 miles an hour is considered a Category 5, the worst, Camille would be a Category 6 if there was such a thing. By comparison, Katrina was a Category 3 with winds of 125 miles an hour, and everybody knows how destructive that was. And also, since the destructive power of hurricanes increases exponentially with the wind speed, the difference between 125 and 200 is absolutely enormous. Camille's storm surge when she came ashore in Mississippi was close to 26 feet, the highest ever measured in the U.S. at that time. And having been down to see the damage on the Gulf Coast right after Katrina, the thing about storm surge is it isn't just water. It's water that's choked with debris, with trees and cars and every other kind of rubble, and it's rolling in and it's rolling out and it's just crushing everything. The destructiveness is astounding. And Camille had the second lowest barometric pressure ever measured at the time, with barometric pressure being the more accurate measure of hurricane power. So Camille was without a doubt one of the greatest, scariest storms of all time, and it wound up in Nelson County. As John Grisham wrote in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, he said, it was not uncommon, he grew up in Mississippi, it was not uncommon when I was a child and student in Mississippi to hear horrific tales from coast residents who had survived Camille. For almost 40 years, it was a well-established belief that there simply never could be another storm like Hurricane Camille. When Camille hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast, whole towns were just simply obliterated. 170 people were killed, many never found. This destruction was staggering. People in Mississippi and Louisiana were still reeling from the damage on the coast, and it was being widely reported in the newspapers. When Camille kind of just went off the National Weather Service radar screen, it was disintegrating, it was moving north, and as these things generally do, it was losing power and kind of losing its vortex. Also, in that part of the world, they didn't want to drought, so they didn't mind the rain. And it headed straight for us here in central Virginia. So the National Weather Service more or less went to sleep on the job. But nobody was following this thing. And 2 days later, again, in the middle of the night, but this time without any warning whatsoever, the remnants of the storm collided with the moisture-laden weather system down at Nelson, and it triggered what's believed to be one of the heaviest overnight rainfalls in history. Whole mountainsides collapsed, as you can still see here. Houses, cars, cattle, tractor trailers were swept away in the night. 124 people were killed, and many of their bodies were never found. It was, many people later said, like a war zone, and many of the people who later headed up to rescue and recovery operations were ex-military people, men who had served in Vietnam or Korea. And one of the astounding things about this to me was the rapidity with which this community put itself together, created teams. There was no FEMA, there was no federal help, there was no CNN broadcasting 24/7. There was just a bunch of people, hurt people down here, and absolute wreck. So the helicopter started landing on 29 and makeshift tents and little offices set up. The volunteers just poured in here. The earliest group was the Mennonite Disaster Service, who just showed up from somewhere and started, you know, searching for bodies, mucking out houses, and some of them stayed a year to rebuild houses and barns and things. And after this all happened, there was a kind of a period of soul searching in the National Weather Service, because the service had so completely fallen down on the job. One report from the Weather Service said, in sort of in scientific language, something like, "Our system does a good job of predicting predictable events, but anomalous events like this one, things far outside the realm of probability, we cannot predict." Which is sort of like saying, even though it's our job, we really have no idea what's going to happen next. The Weather Service also described Camille as one of the all-time weather anomalies in the United States. So it's you know, people often ask exactly how much rain fell that night. The official State Climatology Office put the total at 27.35 inches in 8 hours. To give you some idea what that means, the hardest rain ever recorded in Virginia before that time came in 1942, when 8.4 inches of rain fell in 12 hours on Big Meadows in Shenandoah National Park. So Camille more than tripled the all-time record. And also, normally, we get 2 or 3 inches of rain a month, you know, averaged out. So that's something on the order of 10 months of rain in one night. But it's generally said that the actual rainfall was higher than that, because there were anecdotal reports of buckets, milk pails, and open containers that completely overflowed with water. So it's hard to say. It's something more than 27 inches in 8 hours. One observer calculated that the total weight of this much rainfall was around 600 million tons. The National Weather Service later estimated that the rainfall in Nelson County that night approached the probable maximum rainfall, which meteorologists compute to be theoretically possible. The probable maximum rainfall, which meteorologists compute to be theoretically possible. It was almost not possible for there to be more rain than there was that night. A team of geologists who came in afterwards to examine the damage estimated that about 2,000 years of erosion occurred in a single night. And other scientists estimated that this event occurs on average only once in more than 1,000 years. At UVA, a researcher looked at paleo floods and said it could have been even more rare, once in 3 to 6,000 years. So, in answer to the lady who said this field is overplowed, I did stop and ask myself while working on this, you know, why? Why retell a story like this? It's so sad. I mean, there's people in this county, I think, who are still, to some degree, traumatized by what happened 50 years ago. Why go back to this? Well, for one thing, I felt like this book, and perhaps all books about disasters, are kind of a comfort, because they're a way of processing our fear. And fear is one of the predominant emotions of our age. I mean, I think people read disaster books for two main reasons. They want to vicariously relive the experience to get as close as possible to actually confronting death, almost to pre-experience death in itself. I think that's why kids love horror movies. And they also want to hear the analytical and scientific sort of left-brain explanation of why it happened. I want to know why, what it felt like to be frightened right down to my bones, and I also want to earnestly seek some reasonable explanation as to why. You know, we live in spooky, scary times when all kinds of terrible things happen seemingly without warning and without reason. It's not just like that Los Angeles is on fire, but the retrospective, the photographs of this past year are just filled with bodies from random shootings. To read a story about people who experienced a horrific event like this and then live to tell of it helps you confront the possibility that it may happen to you. And what would you do if you did that? Down in Mississippi, I talked to a woman named Janice Spaganga, and she said, once you're trapped, once the storm takes hold and you realize you've made a mistake, it's just too late to correct that mistake. It's too late to get help from flying debris and rising water. You're trapped, and your only choice is to pray. Once the water rises, once your exits are cut off, once the building starts to fall apart, it's too late to say, let's leave. That's a description of sheer terror. But she lived through it. And that's a kind of a comfort. On another practical level, I wanted to write this story because I just didn't think anybody had ever told the whole story properly, it seemed to me. And so I wanted to tell this tale in kind of a novelistic fashion, following maybe half a dozen key characters from a few days before the first ominous raindrop all the way through. And I also wanted to tell the scientific story to explain what's known about hurricanes in general and this one in particular. And I was lucky enough to make the acquaintance of a meteorologist who had worked for NASA and also had studied this particular storm, Jeff Halbert. So we got not along great. And I would say another reason is that it's a warning. I mean, it may be arguable as to whether global warming has increased the likelihood of hurricanes and other severe storms. But what's non-controversial is that over the past three decades, there's been huge development along the coasts, and it's actually made us more vulnerable to hurricanes than we were back in the time of Katrina. Witness Hurricane Sandy up in New Jersey. And so people in these inland areas are also more vulnerable than they realize, because it turns out that there's the death toll from hurricanes is actually greater in inland areas than on the coast, because on the coast everybody's prepared. I mean, they expect America to come. I'm not trying to make you nervous. So I was trying to kind of conceive the feel, the impact of this event on this community, this small rural community. But I realized that you kind of get some sense of it when you notice that there's only two memorials on the grounds of the Nelson County Courthouse in Lovingston. One is to the men from the county who were killed during the Civil War, and the other is those killed by Camille. So I wanted to get a better sense of the exact comparison, so I contacted a Civil War historian who said that if the mortality rates here were about the same as elsewhere, probably about 100 to 150 men from Nelson were killed in the Civil War. By comparison, Camille killed 124, so the death toll is similar. But you could easily argue that Camille had an even more devastating impact on, because everybody knew the war was coming. Most of the men who served and died chose to serve, and the whole thing lasted for 4 years. Camille lasted all of 9 hours and killed people indiscriminately, men, women, and children. Those who died, died in total innocence, Cliff Wood said. To say that Camille has a powerful impact as the Civil War is to say something really powerful indeed. You know, they say that there are plenty of things you can write about, but what you really should write about is the subjects that choose you. And I felt chosen by this and kind of compelled to tell it. And it touched me and amazed me in a variety of different ways. One of them was the response of this community. You know, it gives you so much hope for humanity. Search and rescue teams doing the grim work of recovering bodies, UVA students, black and white, so many people working together to the brink of exhaustion to put the community back together. Somebody said, who helped? Go up in a plane and look down. That's who helped. Everyone helped. And we should all hope that if something equally bad happens, we'll all do the same. Another thing that just really touched me was the intact families. You know, the whole families got swept away that night, like the family of Warren Rand and the Huffmans over on Davis Creek. But they were swept away partly because whole families were still together. which even at that time was unusual in America. And it's increasingly unusual. Usually somebody's in California, somebody's in Colorado, somebody's in Nelson County, who knows where you're up to. And of course, one of the most haunting things about this were the fact that down in the Mississippi Gulf Coast and here, bodies were found that were never identified, still have not been identified. Down there, there were three women whom they called Faith, Hope, and Charity. They buried them with proper reverence, and people put flowers on these graves every year, but no one knows who they were. And here, there were eight people that we never identified. There was a good-looking teenage boy with blonde hair and a little blonde mustache. People said maybe he was a kid hitchhiking from Woodstock through the county. There was a toothless old woman of about 70. There was a heavily muscled man with a tobacco-stained teeth and red beans and rice in his stomach. And most amazing of all, there were two little blonde girls, one about six, still with the baby. Can you imagine that? A little child found, and no one was able to identify what family she came from. And to this day, nobody's ever figured out who these 11 people were. Tissue samples were kept, so possibly someday the DNA would make a match, and somebody will find their long-lost son or brother or father or daughter, but so far it hasn't happened. And I guess at the bottom line in all this, as I say at the end of this book, is that in the face of a biblical tempest like Camille or Katrina, the proper human response is to be overcome with a kind of divine and humble awe, and then to run for dear life.
What a powerful account from Stefan Bechtel.
Yeah, I certainly learned a lot about Camille and its effect on Nelson County.
Mm-hmm. And we're glad that we're able to share with you what we got to sit in on.
Yes,
on the 7th.
Many thanks to Bechtel for giving us permission to record him so we can.
We will be back on the 1st of the year with not only words from many staff members, but also a brief chat with our outgoing current library director and our new incoming director. So we're looking forward to that.
We want to thank the Friends of the Library for their generous support that makes this program and recording it possible. If you would like to learn more or become a friend of the library, you can do so at the link in our show notes or head to jmrlfriends.org.
To make sure you never miss an episode, consider subscribing to this podcast. You can do so in any of your favorite places to listen to podcasts. We are on Stitcher, TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or you can just subscribe on our website at onthesamepage.blueberry.net. That's it for today. Thanks for tuning in.
And we're glad to be
on the same page. Do you want to ugly cry at 2 a.m.?